Good afternoon. I'm calling this meeting of House Finance to order. It is about 1:32 on Monday, January 23rd. Present are Representative Kawasaki, Representative Vice Chair Guerra, Representative Foster, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, Representative Graham, Representative Guttenberg, and Representative Thompson. Myself, Co-Chair Seaton. Today, before we start, I wanted to remind everybody about their cell phones. And and everybody can remember you can't have advertising on your hats.
Name of our state.
Not advertising.
That's fine if that's all it is. So don't forget your cell phones. And today we're going to hear three budget overviews from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, Department of Revenue, and the Judiciary. First up will be transportation. And if you'd like to come up to the mics, we're going to have to end this by 2:10 to provide time. So let's make sure we schedule our times. Then we will have the Department of Revenue, and that will end at 2:50. And so that'll give us an appropriate amount of time for the judiciary. So welcome, Commissioner. Would you...
There you go.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and anyone else with you to testify. And you should all have a folder that has the presentation slides as well as them being electronically on the screens. And I want to recognize that Representative Ortiz has joined us. And go ahead and proceed.
Okay. Well, good afternoon, Co-Chair Seaton and Foster and committee members. I am Mark Lucan, for the record, Commissioner for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. With me today is Amanda Holland, our Administrative Services Director. We'll both be providing testimony today. So the mission of the Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is to keep Alaska moving through service and infrastructure. Per Alaska Statute 4442, the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is responsible for planning, research, design, construction, operation, maintenance, and protection of all state transportation systems and public facilities. We achieve this through our core services and our strategic approach known as results-based alignment. And under that framework, we have four core services that are statutorily or federally required to provide service to our state. First, we preserve and extends the life of existing infrastructure. Operate allows movement on existing infrastructure. Modernize updates infrastructure to meet modern standards and capacity. And finally, provide encompasses the services the department provides to move people and goods. Results-based alignment is a service delivery framework from which we measure the contribution of the services we deliver in support of our mission. Also included on this slide are links to source documents for your reference.
For the record, my name is Amanda Holland. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. This slide provides a 10-year look back of our unrestricted general fund and our designated general fund funding. For our FY 2018 governor's proposed budget, the unrestricted general fund total equals $145.7 million, and our designated general fund total equals $126.9 million. These numbers are close to our fiscal year 2009 levels. This next chart shows all funds by line item. The department's commodities, services, travel, and personal services are trending below fiscal year 2012 levels. Of particular note is travel, which is below the fiscal year 2008 level. On this graph, we are looking at general fund only, which includes unrestricted general fund and designated general fund sources.
And before you proceed, Representative Pruitt has joined us. Go ahead. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. Are we going to entertain any questions in the end or all the way through it?
Commissioner, how would you like to go?
However you would like to do it, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to entertain questions throughout, if that's what you'd like to do.
Representative Guttenberg.
If I may, this is probably going to be first of some many. On slide three, I can't read if that one's five. Going back to three, on is that it? No, I'm sorry, on four, next one. Thank you. So we're looking at personal services, and we're looking at a from 17 management plan to 18 governor on the end, personal services. I'm trying to figure out what part of that, if you've even included it in the program to move, design and engineering out, is that in here at all?
This is our 10-year look back. Right. So do you mean just for...
Well, you have 18 governor, right? So...
Okay, so excuse me, through the Thank chair, you. Representative Guttenberg. What this chart reflects is our total cost, personal services cost for fiscal year 2018, including any reductions of positions that are in the budget, which include design and construction positions.
Okay, so that proposal. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm supposed to do the same thing. So I guess we'll get a further detail because I was under the impression that there wasn't estimates on savings or changes in the budget, or that it was even a savings at all. So I'll look forward to that discussion about what happens in that program to proposal to move design and engineering out of DOT. Well, it stays in DOT. It just becomes a private function, which is still in DOT's budget, if I have that right. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And before we go forward, for the students that are in the room, you heard our little discourse here about going through the chair. The reason that is done is because it controls the flow of conversation and arguments. So if there is an argument going and or disagreement, then what happens is the chairman can easily stop that conversation and go on there. This is not a back and forth. This is a solicitation of information, and sometimes people get carried away like in a discussion conversation. So that's the purpose of going through the chair, and it serves a very useful purpose. Would you proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I mentioned before, on this graph, we're looking at general fund only, which includes unrestricted general fund and designated general fund sources. Two result delivery units. One is highways, aviation, and facilities. The other is the Alaska Marine Highway System, make up 94% of the department's general fund operating budget. This means 94% of our general fund operating budget is dedicated to direct service for Alaskans. In the fiscal year 2018 budget, the Marine Highway System is near the fiscal year 2008 level, while highways, aviation, and facilities is below the fiscal year 2008 level. When looking at all funds for the fiscal year 2018 governor's proposed budget, highways, aviation, and facilities has the largest share of the operating budget. The Marine Highway System is a close second. The majority of the operating budget is dedicated to three core services: preserve Alaska's transportation infrastructure, operate Alaska's transportation infrastructure, and provide transportation services. This chart illustrates total funding by fund group. Capital Improvement Program receipts, also known as CIP receipts, comprise over 50% of the other state funds category. They fund the design, engineering, and oversight of the capital program. In this slide, we broke our department down by the results delivery unit. You can see the funding breakdown by fund category in the second column and the number of positions in the third columns. The three farthest right columns show constitutional, federal, and statutory requirements. The rating of importance column in the middle reflects the department's rating of each program as either critical, important, beneficial, or status quo. In the interest of time today, I won't go line by line. I would like to point out the administration and support results delivery unit. It includes several types of services, such as measurement standards, commercial vehicle enforcement, statewide aviation, program development, and statewide planning.
Which line are you talking about?
If you see on the farthest left, there's the component column, and each of those lines provide the statewide functions that the department performs.
But were you talking about one specific
this
one?
Right here, right? Statewide administrative services.
Right. So, Mr. Chair, what I was showing was the different components that make up the entire results delivery unit, which is administration and support.
Okay, thank you. And we have Representative Kawasaki and Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a couple questions. I know that I think we'll delve a little bit more into some of the legislative fiscal analysis overview, but the couple, I've never seen a graph like this, so it's I kind of like it. But on the rating importance to mission, there's a couple of things: statewide design engineering services, regional design engineering services, and regional construction CIP support components are three of the things that are listed as critical to the mission. But they seem to be taking the hardest hit in this budget. And I just wondered if you can comment on that.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, I want to make sure I understand your question. Were you asking about administration and support or design engineering and construction results delivery units?
Through the chair, on page 9, it talks about the statewide design and engineering services. There's another one, regional design and engineering services components, and then the regional construction. So just those three in general seem like the ones that are targeted for the largest reduction.
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. I have a little bit more to deliver on slide 8.
Okay.
Can I address your question with slide 9?
And before we go on slide 8, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. So we've got to obviously prioritize what we're spending our money on in the budget. There are a number, I don't know how many new roads the department is considering. Every once in a while you hear about the Ambler Road and some others. Where in this on this chart does the money spent on assessing, designing, planning, going through the environmental impact statement process, where is that reflected for new roads that we don't have yet? Is that in the program development and statewide planning component?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett. Well, first of all, the Ambler Road is not a DOT MPF project, but it's beyond that. Yes, the answer is yes. Where we have personal services for planning and programming, that's where our statewide transportation improvement program is developed. And so any funding that would be put toward design, engineering, or even construction would be worked out through that component.
Through the chair.
Representative Gehr.
The spending in that section is $7.8 billion of other and only, and maybe, is it $7.8 million in other and $268,000 in UGF? What is the other? Because that can't all be federal.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. The other state funds is comprised of a number of fund sources, primarily the majority of which, over 50%, is capital improvement program receipts, and that's authority in to spend in the operating budget capital improvement program monies, which come through the federal government in the capital budget.
Thank you. Through the chair. Commissioner, would you be able to get us a list of the new roads that are under consideration, design, environmental impact statement, all those categories, new roads, and what's currently being spent on them at this point?
Through the chair, we certainly will. And I can tell you, you know, I have given, you know, the planning and programming folks four priorities for our capital program: to preserve our system, preserve our bridges, to if we're going to add capacity, you know, a new road or maybe a new passing lane, it's got to be based on a safety data, and then another category, final category, called a time trap, which is where we've started work on a federal project and we're running up against the time limit to either make a decision to go forward or cancel the project. So that's it. That's what our where our priorities are. But I will, if there are new roads that we're actually contemplating, we'll be happy to get those for you.
Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg, did you have on?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought maybe it had been cleared up before then. On page 8, the under the column of constitutional requirement and federally requirement, according to both these two pages, this one and the next page, the only thing that's constitutionally required is the commissioner's office. But you also list equal opportunity, employment, and civil rights, and that is federally requirement. Aren't there state constitutional requirements that deal with this issue? And I'll leave it to you to go back and look at that again. But I think the entire basis of that line is we have Elizabeth Baratchevich building gallery downstairs, so I think that might be need to be looked at again. But that's it. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, we can certainly
thank you.
Thank you. And then Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your what I'm wondering about here is in the methodology and the rating of importance to the mission and the rating of effectiveness. What was the methodology that you used within, and I'm guessing that's within the department, and who determined those criteria?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton. For rating of importance, our primary guidance was provided in the memorandum from co-chairs Seaton and Foster. And so we went by that definition for what constitutes critical, important, beneficial, and status quo. And for rating of effectiveness, actually, Commissioner is going to explain that in just a moment, if that'll work for you. We did have a number of individuals in the department assist us with both ratings. It was the department's executive team as well as some subject matter experts in specific areas.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Couple things I just wanted to touch on real quick. In slide 7, which is your graph, of course, this really highlights the switch that you've done from UGF to EGF. First, the amount. Second, the thought process behind that particular change.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I want to make sure I understand your question. So you're asking about the why there's a significant change in DGF and UGF?
Yeah, obviously UGF has been supplemented for DGF the amounts, is, but really it's more of kind of the thought process. Why is that taking place? What is the methodology that got you to that point?
Through the chair, thank you.
Go ahead.
So what we would like to do, and it ties back to our results-based alignment and the way that we're working our department and being able to show that the services we are providing are directly connected to the statutory requirements and to our mission. And so with the swap to a designated general fund amount, this is the proposed Alaska Transportation Maintenance Fund, it would allow us to take monies that drivers and motorists pay, for example, in motor fuel tax, and apply that directly to the preservation and operation of the roads that they are using to drive their vehicles upon. And so we believe that by having this as a designated general fund, we can show Alaskans exactly what service we're providing and how that service is benefiting the tax that they're using. So they're paying and they see the immediate benefit. A pothole gets patched. We have good striping, so there's safe passing in our safety corridors.
Ms. Chair.
Representative, follow up.
So I appreciate that. There's kind of a mix here. So I appreciate the fact that I believe fee for service is really kind of a needed entity. If there's something that costs in other committees or other departments that I've dealt with, DNR is a great example. When there's situations where the public is receiving a benefit in some capacity or a particular industry, like timber, for example, then the fee should cover the cost of doing that. And so I don't have an issue with that. The challenge here is how do we, and this is not really something that I'm looking for you to answer, it's more of a general question, is how do we deal with, right now we have tuned the public into the thought process that the budget is around UGF. And so this movement looks like there's a reduction of UGF, which signals to the public that we've made a change different than we've actually made. And so I guess maybe that's just, and that's not, I'm not asking you to answer that, but I'm highlighting that as we go through this process, that's going to be on my mind. I want to make sure that we're clearly articulating to the public what we've done with this budget. I agree, completely agree, that I'd like for people to see where their money is going to and that fee for service concept. But how does that mesh with being very clear and transparent with the public in what we're actually going to do with the budget this year? It almost looks like if I'm just an outsider, not having been in this heard this meeting, I might go, oh, they moved it to DGF because they wanted to make it look like they had a larger cut to UGF this year than they might have already had. So that's more of a statement, Mr. Chair, in terms of that particular balance. I do have one other question, though. Okay, and it's
before you proceed, just so you're aware, that's why we asked for charts to be all funds identified instead of just UGF, because that would have been hiding the ball, and this is showing where the ball is. So,
right, and I don't think they're trying to hide. It's just more of how do we make sure, because there's that UGF is within the mindset of the public out there. So I don't know. That's something that's for our discussion as we go forward. But I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. And then one other question.
Follow-up question.
Specific, and it's just real quick on the privatizing of the federal. My only question is: Are we getting rid of those PCNs, the 76 PCNs that are, or the 76 positions? Are we just not funding the positions, and going through privatization?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think it would be best to wait until we see what the settlement between the state and the GGU comes out as to exactly what the result of that will be, and then that'll, I think, will explain better what's happening.
One more follow-up. So then, now it does. Currently, the agency contracts for 55% of the work. Have we had PCNs though that represent that 55% of the work? And 55% is for this year. I don't know how long 55% has been kind of the going number of privatization. Do we currently have PCNs that fill in that 55% that is currently privatized? So, Mike, really the question is related to
if we feel comfortable with the 55%, can we remove those PCNs? I mean, we're not eliminating people. It really is truly eliminating those PCNs and potentially then leave the remaining 45%, those PCNs valid. Is that something that we might be able to do?
I was going to say this for the end. Through the chair, Representative Brett, I was going to say this for the end, but I think it might be worth at least communicating now so that, that the entire committee understand exactly what our department is doing, you know, and maybe not, you know, specifically answer that question, but hopefully we'll give you a better idea of what we really are doing and what we intend to do as a department. So, you know, ultimately, in keeping with our core value of excellence, which really, you know, drives us to look to continuously improve, and in light of our state's fiscal crisis, we're seeking to optimize the delivery of our capital program. You know, so that's really what this effort is about. And a key component of that optimization is careful review of our workforce size and its capabilities. All right, and so that's really what this effort is about, is it's a look to optimize the delivery of our program, you know, as best we possibly can. And so I know that's probably not as satisfying an answer as what you're looking for, but we're not sure that 55% is the right number. Maybe it is, maybe it's not. You know, and again, I think the feasibility study that we ultimately will do is going to help us make that determination.
Thank you, Chair. And thanks, Commissioner, and we'll come back to that at the end, I'm sure. So, Representative Thompson, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I do have one that I just wanted to get clear in my head. Your designated DGF funds on slide 7 shows a huge increase. Does that increase in DGF, does that include the governor's proposed increase on gas tax?
Through the chair. Representative Thompson, yes, that does include the governor's proposed bill.
Follow up on that?
Representative Thompson.
So if that bill didn't pass, we'd have to come back and readjust the whole formula here?
Through the chair. Representative Thompson, yes, we would have to readjust our ask for the 2018 budget.
And then,
Representative Thompson.
Different subject to another question. Just out of curiosity on the engineers and design privatizing, isn't most of the engineers funded by 90% federal money?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, I think that, again, the discussion really needs to focus on what we're doing. And what we're doing is optimizing, looking to optimize delivery of our program. Privatization was probably not the best use of terms, but you know, our real focus and our real effort is to optimize the delivery of our program.
Follow up. If it is being funded basically 90% by federal funds, what's the possibility that most of this engineering would be privatized to firms that are actually working for companies in Alaska, but they are designing and engineering roads, et cetera, in Seattle and Portland instead of having it done here in the state? Would that mean then the federal dollars would be going to Seattle and Portland instead of staying in state?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, again, I think the ability for us to make that determination right now is, you know, we don't have that data, but I believe that the feasibility study that we will do will help us make those determinations.
And I'm looking forward to the further discussion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that's a very good question. And is that a correct number, 90%, give or take, is federally funded for those positions? Is that correct?
Through the chair, Rep. Foster, I think, yes, that's pretty close to the actual number.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, you keep using the word optimization in the term of the reorganization or the privatization. I'm not the study you're talking about is not out. So, and I don't know when it's due out. If you mentioned it while I had stepped out, I missed it. I'm sorry. I don't know if that's the correct word until that's done to see what you have in there. But I've been under the impression that a lot of the work currently is design work is out of office, that is contracted out anyway, in that there's going to be a crease in contracting and oversight for work that's done outside of our facilities to begin with. So there's increased costs. When is that study supposed to be done? Is it going to be done before our budget process is complete, or where in our process will that work product be out so we can examine it?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, our intent is, at least for now until I've heard differently, is that we are crafting a request for proposal for this study to be done. We expect to probably have that on the street by the end of this month, with an award somewhere toward the end of February, with a start work in March. The expectation is that that study may take 6 months. But I think the an important point to make at this point is that where we are with the governor's budget, there hasn't been any outsourcing, there hasn't been any privatization with the current budget. Therefore, the feasibility study right now does not need to be complete before the end of this this cycle.
Okay, if I may, Mr. Chair, just follow up.
Representative Governor.
I guess I was looking at the earlier budgets, and I asked the question between 17 management and 18 governor, that's a proposal. Maybe I heard wrong that some of that was in here, but I guess we'll have to discuss that as well. Or I don't know if we're going to have a any discussion, or the transportation subcommittee is going to have a discussion on what that study means and what the criteria was for it. I don't sit on that subcommittee, but I certainly would be interested. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Foster, and then we'll get to the end of the slides here before we run out of time. Representative Foster.
Thank you. To that last question, I think those are issues that we will address. And the other thing I wanted to mention is we did have a meeting with the commissioner this morning. Of those 76 positions, not all of those positions are filled, and some of them may be part-time. We've asked the commissioner for the information on the breakdown on all that, and that's information that we can provide back to the committee. So,
thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
All right, we're
slide 8.
Yeah. So we're back on slide 8. We left the number of Alaskans served column blank. And the primary reason is it's really a challenge to measure this quantitatively. The state's transportation infrastructure directly and indirectly impacts nearly every Alaskan every day. The system is working all the time, providing connectivity and access for drivers, pilots, and passengers, and delivering goods such as food and medicine, or services such as emergency response. We indicated effective on our rating of effectiveness as we are currently meeting the department's mission. Results-based alignment was implemented last year, and while we are beginning to see some trends in performance data, it is still maturing.
The Design, Engineering, and Construction Unit is responsible for the design, engineering, and oversight of the capital program. This includes roads, bridges, and runways, generally referred to as horizontal construction, as well as facilities, which is often called vertical construction. The Design, Engineering, and Construction Results Delivery Unit is tied to the state's infrastructure, which has been developed to address the unique needs of Alaskans on the move. Only 2% of Alaska's land area is accessible by road. 82% of Alaska communities are not connected to the road system. For easier reference on this slide, the regional components have been combined into one line for design and one line for construction. The State Equipment Fleet Results Delivery Unit procures, maintains, and disposes of vehicles, equipment, and attachments that are owned and operated by the executive branch agencies, legislative affairs, and the court system. It is a shared service responsible for 7,129 pieces of state equipment and vehicles.
An example of our effectiveness using results-based alignment and our core services is for snow and ice removal by the regional highways and aviation components. For 2017, department-wide, we experienced 231 winter weather events, which means a snow or an ice or a wind event, and met our time response goal 96.6% of the time. Another effectiveness example is provided by the Marine Highway System. The on-time departure rate for 2016 was 92%, which is a slight increase from 2015's rate of 91%. The Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is an economic driver for Alaska. According to a 2016 economic impact study, every dollar invested in the Marine Highway System returns $2.30 of economic benefit to the state. According to reports from 2011, the Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport's economic impact is 1 in 10 jobs in Anchorage, and Fairbanks International Airport's economic impact is 1 in 20 jobs in Fairbanks. If you'd like to know more about how the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities is using results-based alignment to align its budget to core services and increase its accountability through performance data, I'd be happy to provide more information or meet one-on-one with each of you. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before you today. That concludes our briefing.
Thank you. And going back to slide 9 for just a moment, we have a couple of units, the first one and the third one, that are rated of importance to the mission as beneficial. Most of the things have been critical, and we have state equipment fleet is important. How would you characterize the harbor development program development? See, it's fairly small. What is the nature of that component?
Mr. Chair, the harbor program development program looks at harbors that are and ports that are scattered throughout the state, and they help with maintaining or developing those ports and harbors. It's a federal pass-through program.
Okay, thank you. And how about the statewide public facilities? I noticed that's rated as beneficial as well.
Mr. Chair, statewide public facilities, this particular component is a group of design and construction engineers who oversee the construction of facilities for various agencies. So they don't always work on transportation and public facilities. They often assist with things like the a fish hatchery or the scientific crime lab in Anchorage.
So for this rating, it's not that it's a unneeded, but it just directly affects your core mission. It may be an RSA through some other agency. Is that my understanding?
Mr. Chair, yes, that is correct.
Okay, thank you. Representative Kawasaki, Representative Tilton, Representative Grant, and we're just about out of time. So
just on the, thank you, Representative Seaton brought up the Harbor Development Program, and you said that it's a federal pass-through. It's almost 300,000 UGF, and it's not required federally. Is there somebody else that can do that job?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, this is not a program that I am intimately familiar with. To give you more details, I'd like to get back to you on that.
Okay, thanks.
And, and any of these things, the subcommittees will take up in detail and go through. Of course, they're going to drill down much deeper into each one of these aspects and bring a report back to us, recommendations of is there something that we can do to save money. We also want to look at fees or discounts or anything else that you're doing in the subcommittee process. That's the indirect expenditures, which is the other thing. There's two reports, and so we will continue to specifically to look at that and make sure that we're collecting all we can for services we're providing. So Representative, I think it was Tilton and then Gren. Oops, Kawasaki. Okay.
That was just a side question because you asked it first, but I do have a question back to the DOT privatization and why there wasn't a feasibility study done prior to putting this in fiscal year 18 budget.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. In the collective bargaining agreements, feasibility studies are required if we anticipate layoffs of permanent or probationary employees. For the proposed budget of FY 2018, we do not anticipate any layoffs, and so a feasibility study is not required by collective bargaining ahead of time.
Follow up very quickly, though. We're past time.
From our standpoint, we want to make sure that this actually does save money. And I know that out of the 55% of the design work, does that also include when you contract with the municipality to take over the design work, like they did in the city of Fairbanks, for instance?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we'll have to get back to you on that question. I won't try to answer it right now, but it'd be better for us to give you an accurate answer.
Good. Representative Tilton and then Grant, and then we're out of here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may be more appropriate in a subcommittee environment, but in regards to the programs under DOT that were paused on the road projects, are those accounted for at all, or how those were accounted for?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, I'm not really sure what your question is. I know which projects you're talking about, but not really sure what you're asking.
Okay, maybe I can have you come and talk to me later.
Okay,
thank you.
Representative Gren.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the cost through fees percentage, some of those are zero, some of those are up to 100% throughout the matrix here. Do those swing wildly? Do you see some of those change dramatically from year to year? Is that something that's trackable in the last 5 and 10 fiscal years?
Through the chair, Representative Gren, I do not know the specific answer to your question, but I will get that for you.
Mm-hmm. And thank you very much for the presentation. The slide presentation is helpful. And so if any member is wanting to follow this more closely, they can also participate and attend the subcommittee meetings, which will delve more deeply into recommendations coming forward on DOT. Thank you. Now we're going to go to the Department of Revenue, and we're going to take a brief break while they load a slide package. It'll be no more than, we're going to try again, 3 minutes. Good afternoon again. Come back to order. And we now have the Department of Revenue for a high-level overview. And again, we'll need to cut off this about 2:50, so we have a half hour. So welcome, Commissioner. Would you introduce yourself and have your assistants do that as well?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Dan DiBartolo. I'm the Admin Services Director for the Department of Revenue.
I'm Jerry Burnett. I'm the Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue.
Thank you, Chairman Seaton, for this opportunity. I will just make a couple of quick introductory remarks, and then I will turn it over to Director DiBartolo to walk us through the presentation, and we have Deputy Commissioner Burnett here to answer questions as well. Focusing just primarily on the first two slides, two and three, for the Department of Revenue, our mission statement and the various functions of the department. Slide two, the Department of Revenue's mission is relatively simple. It's to collect, distribute, and invest the funds for public purposes. For the most part, we're pretty much laser focused on that very specific mission in all of the functions within the department. We have a fairly narrow focus, and it's on those particular components. Our core programs, Treasury Division, of course, is our investment arm for the state. That is where our investment managers reside, is within the Treasury Department. It's also where our cash management functions reside. Tax Division is our collection component for taxes for the state of Alaska. Permanent Fund Division, of course, is distribution of the permanent fund. And Child Support Enforcement, which is collection and distribution of funds for the purposes of our federal mandate on child support enforcement. On slide three, we also have various authorities, corporations, and boards that reside within the purview of the Department of Revenue, but generally function autonomous from the department itself. That's the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, the Alaska Retirement Management Board, the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, and the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority. All reside within the Department of Revenue, all function semi-autonomously from the Department of Revenue. And with that, I will turn it over to Dan DiBartolo to walk through the rest of the slides.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Chairman, and members of the committee. I am now on page four, the Department of Revenue share of total agency operations. Right off the bat, there is a note here by the Legislative Finance Agency that I want to call out, because this change over time seems to be an important function for us to talk about. The general fund budget grew by $5.1 million between FY08 and FY18, the governor's request, with an average annual growth of 2%. And this here, it says this equates to $83 per resident worker. I'd like to comment that $83 is a portion of our actual total GF budget, not the actual increase of $5.1 million, just for that clarification on that note there. Now, when we talk about trends, as you're looking at this graph, obviously you want to know why the budget increased at the beginning of this time span, and I want to give some context to that. First of all, in FY08 and FY09, one of the notable increases was the implementation of HB 2001, and that was changes to oil and gas production tax, or ACES, and that allowed for approximately $1.26 million to be added to our budget for audit masters, including additional support staff and money to implement those changes. Also during that time, which you'll probably hear time and time again, is the bargaining unit compensation, including health insurance, saw a significant increase that year. During the time period of FY10, FY11, you'll notice that's the next significant jump on the chart. I'd like to point out a couple of other things. We did add two positions during that time, petroleum commercial analyst positions for gas, land, production tax. But a lot of the other changes were actually fund source changes. In the division of child support, what is happening is ARRA funds, or the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act funds, were going away, and we had to replace those. So we had approximately $826 million in funds while that stimulus was lapsing. And also, for quite some time, child support was receiving designated general funds, and those at that time were switched to a GF match in the amount of $5.9 million. And we also had a cut constitutional budget reserve. Our management fees were changed to GF in that same year in the amount of another $2.1 million. So while it looks like there's a significant increase in our agency GF budget, especially in that 10 to 11, I want to give some context that most of that was fund source change and not a pure growth in our operations.
Reverend Gutenberg.
Thank you. I see it referenced someplace else, but I'm looking for more than a number. When you were talking about the 09 management plan and the addition of additional audit masters, is there some place where you can talk, and it might not even be in this presentation, but down the road, as an example or a value that the additional audit masters brought into the state? I know they have like 6 years to do an audit. I don't know if we've ever not done one in time, but it brought us farther, closer up to date, so the lag isn't there. But is there any value that you've given that the state has gotten fiscally that those additional audit masters have brought to the budget?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg. For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. It's very difficult to quantify a number that would be involved in the audit masters. What happened when we switched from a gross tax to with first the PPT and then to ACES and then SB 21, that the complexity of dealing with a net tax versus a gross tax, we felt like we needed to bring in people that had higher level auditing experience and to the extent possible people that had oil company experience as well. And so the audit masters, rather than being auditors on the ground, really function more in a training and review and support position to make sure that, in fact, we were capturing all of the value that we was available to us within those audits versus them actually generating additional revenue themselves. So I don't think we can put an actual dollar value on that.
Thank you.
Commissioner, do you feel that the audit masters actually paid for themselves? I mean, did their expertise in the audit trail actually, you think, had recoveries for the state that probably superseded their personnel expense?
Chairman Seaton, I believe they have, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just didn't know if I was cutting ahead of somebody.
No, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, through the chair. While we're on this, two-part question. So, obviously, we're behind on audits. I mean, just behind in that we're not auditing this year's oil tax payments. We're auditing oil tax payments from a number of years ago. There's a statute of limitations. So, the two-part question is, are we comfortably online to not miss any statute of limitations in auditing oil company tax returns? And do you believe that there's any loss to the state in being able to do a thorough audit based on the auditing staff that we have, or do you have an adequate auditing staff to do both of those things, keep up on time and not lose any money in terms of incomplete audits?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. We are comfortably on schedule with the oil and gas tax audits. We have enough auditors to complete those. We're actually in a two-year audit cycle now where we're auditing 2 years at a time, so we're catching up 1 year every year. Hope to be at about a three-year lag in the audits within two more years. That three-year lag is about the minimum that we can actually achieve, simply because it takes quite a while to compile the data and get all the questions answered necessary to complete the audit. So that three-year audit window is about where we want to lock in at. And it's going to take us two more years to get there. As far as completing the audits, I think we're seeing the stress on that more in some of our other tax types, not in the oil and gas tax audits, but there are other tax types that we would like to audit more fully, and we simply don't have enough auditors to do all of those.
Thank you, Chair. Just a brief
Follow-up.
Yeah. What are those, and do you think that we're missing out on revenue that exceeds what it would cost to properly do those audits?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we do believe that there's revenue out there to be gained. I guess I'm a little hesitant to say which ones we're not auditing fully, because we prefer that everybody thinks that we're watching them. I would like, if it's okay with the chair, I'd rather answer that offline.
Sure.
if that's possible.
Thank you, and I'm sure the subcommittee will be looking at that as well. Further questions, Representative Pruitt, and then Representative Ortiz.
Just since we're on the auditing discussion, just to clarify, are we getting past the? Because we should be towards, kind of halfway through the statute of limitations, the really complex ACES audits that took so much of that time. We should be moving away from those really complex audits and into the new structure, which was, I don't want to call it simple, but it wasn't as complex as that, as the ACES structure. Is that one of the reasons why we're potentially able to move faster now? And at a certain point in time, do we get to a point where that stress is not on the auditors in the same capacity that it is currently?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we're now fully into the ACES audits, and that has allowed us to be able to combine audits, and we've been through that first set of net tax audit cycle, so the auditors are more cognizant of the issues, the taxpayers are more aware of the questions we're going to ask, and we now are actually in a time frame where we're actually auditing tax returns where regulations were in place before the taxes were due, which has certainly helped everybody being more compliant. And so we expect that that as we move through that, we will see greater and greater compliance, less and less adjustments, and be able to audit more quickly.
Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
When we look at the history of audits, and particularly in the oil and gas industry, have they generally resulted in significant amounts of money generated after the audits have been done, or has it generally been not really having that much of an impact in terms of overall revenue?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that has varied from year to year, but we typically expect something in the neighborhood of $200 million a year in audit adjustments. Sometimes it takes those will be litigated and reduced over time. We're thinking as we continue to move forward, that's probably going to be more in the $100 million a year area as people are more and more aware of the expectations from the state.
Thank you.
And Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Moving on from auditors to investment officers. How does the state compensate investment officers through salary, performance-based, and is it a comparable to the private sector or not?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, they are salary-based. They're exempt state employees. Their salaries are at the high end of state wages to be as competitive as we can be with the private sector. But for the most part, if you had to put a general statement on them, they are paid less than they would make in the private sector.
Follow-up,
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we were more competitive with the private sector, would we be able to attract people that could make us more money? We'd have a better return on our investments or not? I mean, how do we compare with our investors' returns compared to private?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, our investment officers do quite well as far as the returns that they achieve. We've got really two different models that we use. The Treasury with the ARM board investors, we tend to bring in young people that have a lot of capacity, and we actually train them and get them certified to do the investment work, and so that's a little bit more stable staff at the permanent fund, where they actually go out and go to the market to hire investment officers. That they've been able to bring in some really good people, but they tend to have a little bit higher turnover there.
One last follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Out of curiosity, you brought up the ARM board. It was curious to see that last year the ARM board invest quite a bit of money, but they lost 0.043% on the fund instead of making us money. I mean, they have an answer as to what happened?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, if you look across the board for similarly situated investment funds like this, most of them lost money last year. The permanent fund was the exception, but that was driven primarily by the sale of their shares within the Juno Therapeutics, which was essentially a venture capital investment that played out very well, that went public, and they made a substantial return on that. So absent that, permanent fund would have been kind of in that same area as well. Typically, the ARM board and the permanent fund investment returns have been similar over time. Obviously, they have a slightly different investment profile, different portfolio, but in 33 years, the ARM board has outperformed the permanent fund 22 of the 33 years, but it's by very small margins, and so they essentially have the same return history.
Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I think we need to move off of slide four here. We're going to get through.
Thank you, Mr.
Minutes.
Chairman. Again, Dan DiBartolo, for the record.
Next page is.
Here on slide five, just to reset our minds on scale, currently we are on the previous slide, we were on agency operations, and we're looking at tens of millions. On slide five, we're now looking at all funds, the Department of Revenue line items, and we're in scales of hundreds of millions with 50 million increments here. The most notable change when you look at this particular graph, of course, is the area in red that increases from FY10 through FY17 on a pretty steady ramp, and that's under the services line. So specifically, I'd like to give context to that. Those deal with manager fees in both the ARM board and in the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And during that period of growth from FY11 to FY16, and the ARM board fees went from approximately $34 million to $62 million for a total increase of $28 million. And at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, manager fees went from approximately $76 million to $151 million, and that's an increase of $75 million. So that entire approximately $100 million that you're seeing where it kind of ramps the graph up is almost entirely management fees, to give some context. At the beginning of this blue area, there is some growth in personal services, and I will give some context to that. In FY8 and FY09, we did add positions, again, from the tax division, between FY08 and FY10, it was 16 positions altogether, and also contractually obligated salary and health adjustments caused those increases on that area.
Representative Ortiz.
So is it as simple as these funds increase in value, there's a set, like, percentage of management fees, so therefore if the fund increases in value, the fees are going to go up automatically? Is it that simple?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. Yes, that's exactly what's happening.
Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, in the same vein, obviously there's been a discussion, fees, or if we bring that in-house. Your thoughts? I mean, could we bring more in house? I know they would like to do a little bit more of that with the permanent fund. What could we potentially save if we were to help you move in that direction? I know some of that's on us.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the kind of a rule of thumb, it's about 3 to 5 times. The cost for to have an outside manager versus managing in-house, the kind of the state of the art for these funds is to bring as much in-house as possible, as everybody's trying to squeeze just that little bit more return. That seems to be the way that most are doing that, is to bring as much in-house as possible. You have this body has funded additional personnel inside managers for both the permanent fund and the treasury and for the armboard investments over the last couple of years. Those are being filled or are filled, and we expect to continue to bring us more in-house as we develop that in-house capacity. There are certain areas that we simply won't ever bring in-house, some of the private equity and some of the others that it's best left to the experts that have very focused expertise. But a lot of it can be brought in-house and at substantial savings.
Just follow up on that.
Follow up, Reverend Pruitt.
Is there plans to do more of that in this coming fiscal year, or is that more on us in how we appropriate the money that would influence your decision making in that way?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I'd ask Dan whether we actually put more in the budget, personnel in the budget this year. I do know that we are in the process of continuing to hire those positions that have been approved in the past. Okay. And do we have more in the budget this year?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we did not put additional funding this year in the budget specifically for that, but that was in an effort to keep all overall costs down.
And just to follow up on that, and I think that probably goes into I think the legislature and probably in terms of you guys talking to OMB and what is we'd probably need to make sure that there was that offsetting that we can see. I mean, and we can see a reduction last year, but that may have been there was also a decrease in the market value last year. But you know, how can we correlate that bringing in house truly is bringing that value? If you're able to indicate and show that to us, that might help us as we're going through this process determine additional money will bring that off that savings. It just has to be. We just have to have that, be able to see that. I guess is the best way to put it.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we'll bring some metrics in that we can show you.
Thank you.
Let's go on to slide 5. Oh, and Representative Wilson joined us some time ago.
All right, moving on to slide 6 now, appropriations within the Department of Revenue. Again, we're looking at GF only in this slide provided by LFA. And in particular, I should note that our tax division is our only agency, only core program within the Department of Revenue that is 100% GF funded, and so when they have increases, it affects graphs like these, particularly that blue line. You'll notice in the call out on the left hand side, it outlines some of our increases from 8 to 15, which included the Audit Masters we talked about earlier, two commercial analyst positions, the CBR management fees, and that happened on two occasions where we had additional fees, and in FY 14, one more Audit Master for oil and gas. We also, in FY 14, inherited the film office, and as you know, though, that was later repealed, and those positions went away. While we saw this growth here through the middle of this chart, I want to outline some things the agency did to reduce growth. And as the tax division saw that tax revenue management system, or TRIMS, you may have heard it called, was starting to come online, become effective. We were starting to see these automation gains associated with that system. And so they said, well, now we can look at some of these positions to reduce. So between FY15 and FY16, where you see that steeper drop, we eliminated 11 tax positions, including IT that supported that system, a petroleum policy analyst, a commercial analyst, and some other positions that would deem not harm the mission further if we eliminated those. And that was to a total of $1.2 million. We also eliminated the three film office positions for $346,000. On the Treasury side, we eliminated an additional $600,000 in CBR management fees. That represents the bulk of that decline there you see in the graph. On the child support side, between FY15 and FY18, where you see the decline in that graph, child support has eliminated 27 positions to the tune of about $1.55 million in GF match. They also closed their Juneau and Wasilla satellite offices. That was the best ways they could find the efficiencies they needed to gain.
Representative Ortiz.
So in that particular area, does it mean that we're less effective in getting enforcing child support laws, et cetera, because of that?
If I could, this is Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue, through the chair to Representative Ortiz. We've made a very strong push toward not being less effective, and I believe that the numbers will bear us out in our effectiveness reports that we're actually able to do the work with the staff that we have right now.
Thank you.
Okay, let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now on to slide number 7, appropriations with the Department of Revenue. You'll find that this ledge finance slide is another representation of the all funds slide from page 5, but now it's broken out by appropriation. But here what's handy to note is with APFC, you see the largest increases in the custody and management fees compared to everything else on the chart that shoots up there, and that is commensurate, as we talked about earlier, with the growth of the assets in house. I'll move on to slide 8 then. This is a total funding comparison by fund group of all our funds. So I want to get back to talking about what is where you see anything unusual or out of the ordinary in this chart. And specifically, if you look at the call out here in the chart, you'll see that UGF between FY08 and FY18 for the Department of Revenue increased by $10.6 million. Now, a lot of that is in a very sharp increase from 10 to 11, if you look in the purple on that graph. And I'd like to point out what exactly was happening there. There was a bunch of one-time things that happened in the 1 year. Specifically, we created AGDC through HB 369 to the tune of $15.64 million. And that moved out of our agency the following year. And so you see there's a sharp increase and then a decrease. Other things that happened that year also included sale of GAO bonds for library education and educational research facilities. And that was $4.7 million. And again, that was a one-time item. Usually would not show up in our budget. But that combined with some of the things I mentioned that went to our base earlier in this presentation from 10 to 11 made the sharp increase in UGF from 10 to 11 from 17 million to 51 million and then back down as we went steadily decreasing our UGF expenses. Oh, and I did want to call out of the 10.6 million UGF increase that was outlined there by Ledge Finance, 9.2 million of it is fund source changes for child support and the change of the CBR fees.
Representative Guerra.
Thanks. Through the chair, I'm sure I didn't make any sort of miraculous discovery here, but in FY10, just on unrestricted general funds, you explained why the funds went from roughly $18 million up to $51 million. A lot of that was AGDC. But then when AGDC was moved out, then it became basically a $30 million budget. So is that excess over FY10? Is that gas line related work? There was an increase in sort of the base there that seemed to be consistent through all those years?
Representative Garrett through the chair. Back on slide, I believe it was 4, when I mentioned the increases to base, we found that $5.9 million became a DGF to UGF transfer for child support, and the ARRA funds of $826.8
million.
$826,000. The petroleum commercial analyst positions of $400,000. And the constitutional budget reserve of $2,100,000 all also increased our base, plus the one-time items I mentioned in that year. So we had a lot going on from 10 to 11, and so that's why you see it seems like we go from 17 to 31 if you take the anomalous year out of there. I see what you're saying, but a lot went to our base
in that period of almost the tune of $9 million, and then the trend levels out the rest of the graph down.
Through the chair briefly.
Very quickly.
Yeah, when you, and then you said $2 million when we went to the Constitutional Budget Reserve. What did you mean by that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. The decision was made to pay the management fees with UGF money for the Constitutional Budget Reserve instead of creating a debt to the reserve that would then take an appropriation to pay back.
That's fine. Thanks.
Okay, let's go to the next slides.
Now we're going to get to the charts. I think you saw in the other presentation. I'm just going to cover simple changes on this chart, and please let us know if you have questions. First of all, I'd like to talk about the Treasury Division. Changes in the Treasury Division this year will represent a reduction of $374,200 in GF, and that is going to be one admin position who's moving to the Shared Services of Alaska. We had to target the position for elimination, and they picked it up there to use it more effectively, hopefully, in this new effort. That came with a $25,000 GF cut. And we also had $348,500 in GF that is going to be reduced via fund source changes, allocation of assets changes under Armed Board Management. In unclaimed property, we have no changes to note, but I do want to mention that in FY16, the unclaimed property division did move $12 million to GF from their trust account. Since the inception of that program, they've put $116 million into the GF coffers of the state since the program inception in 1986.
Representative Ortiz.
Can you explain unclaimed property? What is that?
Well, for the record, Jerry Burnett, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Revenue. When you don't cash in a gift card or when you leave money in your bank account and move away or you die and you don't have a will, the money escheats to the state of Alaska. You or your heir or whatever can claim that money, and it's held by the state in trust, but every year we go by and see, well, what's the percentage that's not getting claimed, and we move that to the general fund. If a person brings in a claim later on, they'll still be paid because we have enough money in the trust, but that's what it is.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Chairman. Next, I'll go to the Alaska Retirement Management Board. As I mentioned, under Treasury, we reduced $348,500 in GF, and that has been increased in Armed Board funds here under that component. And then in Armed Board custody and management fees, this year there will be a $12.1 million reduction in Armed Board custody and management fees. Largely, that's because external fees are starting to decline, as we mentioned earlier, as more investments are moving in-house, and also some fees are taken directly from the managed funds, and that's largely why they're doing that reduction. Under the Alaska Municipal Bond Bank Authority, I have no changes this year. On slide 10 now, the Permanent Fund Dividend Division. They are taking a DGF reduction of $177,900. They're eliminating two positions, an information systems coordinator and imaging technician. And they're also reducing $80,000 of that $177,000 is for reducing costs associated with printing applications. They're trying to go more electronic as best they can. Also, one position is being transferred from the Administrative Services Division for our Shared Services Initiative. The Child Support Services Division, they are eliminating $218,000 in GF match. They've eliminated two positions for efficiency gains associated with this new shared services initiative. They've also are eliminating the rest of the $25 fee that is a subsidy to custodial parents. Basically, in our last budget cycle, we had a decrement of $100,000. This year, we're taking another $100,000. the federal government mandates that you charge $25 on any payments to custodial parents above $500. And for years, the state of Alaska basically subsidized that fee. In our current situation, we've decided to phase that out, and that is now being paid by custodial parents. We are also transferring two positions to Administrative Services Division for the Shared Services Initiative and transferring three positions to the Office of Information Technology. Under the Tax Division, we're doing a $307,000 UGF reduction. That includes eliminating two positions, a Revenue Appeals Officer and an Excise Tax Tech. And we have transferred a vacant seasonal position to Treasury and are transferring one position to Administrative Services for the Shared Services Initiative. And then I'm on the next page. Oh, excuse me, I've got two more in here. I need a Beckham attempt. Yes. Got ahead of myself. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. In the Commissioner's Office, I have no funding change, but we are eliminating an AKLNG-related position, and we are transferring in an admin assistant in Anchorage from the Criminal Investigations Unit. Under the Administrative Services Division, we are increasing interagency authority to $445,000. And this is for the positions that are being transferred into Administrative Services. The funding is being left in the agencies, and we will charge the agencies through the cost allocation plan for the services we'll provide under Shared Services. And now on slide 11. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation and the Alaska Corporation for Affordable Housing have no operational funding changes this year. However, AHFC has capital project requests in the amount of $42.55 million, similar to what they have asked for in previous years. That is available online, or, Mr. Chairman, I can detail it if you need. All right. The Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation also has no operational funding change. But like with the ARM board, the APFC management fee section is taking a $9.4 million reduction to under other funds. And just again, they are also doing more assets managed in-house, and they wanted to note that market performance this year has been less than the projected mid-case return scenario, but this will bring their budget in line with anticipated costs.
Okay, thank you. And again, in revenue, there's a number of indirect expenditures. Might point out for the committee, one of those is the 100% tax credit that is allowed for the second $200,000 of educational tax credits. The revenue subcommittee will be looking closely at that, allowing redirect of so much of our tax money to other entities is something that we need to look carefully at, and we'll bring that back as well. There's a number of other credits that are offered that we're going to have to be looking at as well. So we are really out of time for this high-level presentation, but again, members are all invited to attend subcommittee meetings where details will be much further investigated. And so with that, thank you very much, and we will go to our final presentation from the judiciary.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Am I going to get retirement? I'd like to.
We'll take a brief at ease while we're swapping. We'll come back to order, and we now have a presentation by the on the judiciary. And would you introduce yourself for the record and go ahead and proceed with your presentation?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Wolver. I'm the Deputy Director for the Alaska Court System. The mission of the court system in general, of course, our job is to resolve cases. That's why we have a court system. Our mission is to resolve those cases in a way that it keeps our judiciary accessible to the public. It's an impartial system. We like to have just results in accordance with the law, and decide those cases expeditiously and with integrity. These are kind of our guiding principles. But in lean budget times, two of those goals are always kind of at risk. And one is the accessibility of the courts, and the other is how quickly we can resolve cases. Of course, as you know, we close at noon on Friday. That somewhat limits our, you know, the public's access to the court system. And courts are either closing or having greatly reduced hours in some of our small rural magistrate locations. That also affects accessibility. And as we reduce more and more and more our staffing levels, it becomes more and more difficult to do things in a timely manner. But our challenge is, when we manage budget cuts, is to do so in a way that impacts those goals in the least way possible. But there will be impacts, and those are the ones that are most likely to be impacted. This slide you're familiar with from all of the other presentations is our 10-year look back. As you can see, from FY08 through FY15, we had general increases in our budget. Our share, overall share of the general fund budget hasn't changed much. We're still just a little bit above 2%. I think we've gone up 0.16%. But in general, that's a pretty flat level for our total share. I'll talk about the reductions, which show up in FY16, 17, and 18 a little bit later. But at this point, talking about the increases, there are kind of three primary drivers that have led to increase in our budget over the years. One is we've asked for, and legislature has approved, additional judges and staff in court locations where the workloads warranted those increases. The other main driver has been the general salary increases that the legislature approves for non-covered employees, and that includes employees in the judicial branch. And then one other area that is reflected in our budget increase but isn't actually an increase in money is the therapeutic courts. Therapeutic courts in FY10 and 11 were moved. All of the funding associated with those efforts were moved into the court system. This was the plan of Representative Hawker, who thought it would be much easier to kind of oversee and manage those projects if all the money was in one location. So throughout the years with therapeutic courts, a bill would pass, Department of Law would have a fiscal note, public defender would have a fiscal note for the, because attorneys are a part of that whole process, Department of Corrections. And rather than have the money spread out throughout the executive branch's budget and a little bit in the court systems, the legislature took all of those funds and just put them in our budget, and then we have RSAs to the various agencies to fund those. So it's an increase in our budget, but it's not an increase in overall state spending.
Mayor Epigar.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Wolver, on therapeutic courts, how much funding and what year was that it was transferred, and then how much funding is in therapeutic courts proposed for FY18?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I believe the funds from the other agencies were transferred in FY11, and I think this year for FY18, the total cost for therapeutic courts is about $4.7 million.
And through the chair, just
follow up.
Yeah, and in FY11, so $4.7 million this year, and understand the value, but in FY11, what was that amount that was transferred? So it's $4.7 million this year.
I have got that here in 1 second. I believe, let's see, in FY11, it was about, well, I've got glasses, but not quite this good of glasses. Looks like about $3.5 million. It went up to a total, I think at the peak we were just a little over $5 million, and now we're down to $4.7
million. Thank you.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What percentage of Alaska's population has access to therapeutic court services? Is that pretty much an urban thing, or is that throughout the state?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, there are lots of opportunities in the urban centers, but we also have therapeutic courts in Ketchikan. Depends how your definition of urban and rural. Okay, that's pretty urban for Southeast, but rural in other eyes. Juneau, Bethel are other main areas. We have them, you know, in Kenai, Palmer, Anchorage. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
This is this chart also shows our 10-year look back, but broken down by line item. As you can see, the biggest part of our budget, which isn't unusual, is our personal services. They make up just about 3/4 of our entire budget. And the only other category you see there that kind of changes much at all is the second largest category, which is our contractual services, and that just reflects the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the therapeutic courts were moved into our budget, and that's where they show up. Same 10-year look back, but separates out therapeutic courts. You can see them at the bottom, and this chart also includes the Alaska Judicial Council and the Commission on Judicial Conduct. Those are the very bottom lines. They are part of the judicial branch of government, but they are separate from the court system itself. And this is general fund only. The next slide looks pretty much identical because 97% of the court system's budget is general fund. So this is all funds, but it looks an awful lot like the other one. And that's what this slide shows. The green is the general fund dollars. We have a small amount of money in other areas. We have 1.25 in federal program receipt authority. We don't actually receive that much, but that's how much we have authority to receive. 1.8 million in other state funds. And mostly those are interagency transfers for our Family Law Self-Help Center, for Mental Health Trust Authority. We get money from the Public Defender Agency for transcripts and appeal cases, and all those together make up that category. We have $518,000 in designated general funds. Those are alcohol tax proceeds that necessarily go towards therapeutic court participant treatment. But the other almost $5 million is the 97% that's general funds. But here's this, but of course, those were like the increases and looking back 10 years, but we're not in that environment anymore. Now we're in budget cutting mode. Through FY, if the legislature approves our proposed reduction this year of $3.67 million, we will, over the last 3 years, have reduced our cost by just about $11 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So has there been any analysis done that now that you're closed half a day, how far cases may be behind, how longer, mm-hmm. how much longer somebody may be staying in jail, mm-hmm. How far some of the OCS cases that come before are kind of thrown out because of that time restraint?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have taken quite a good look at how closing at noon on Fridays affects things. It doesn't affect things as much as one might think for a couple of reasons. One, although we're closed half a day, our employees work from 4:30 to 5. The court closes at 4:30. Employees work from 4:30 to 5, though, to help keep up with the workload so that they don't fall behind. And it's a half hour at the end of every day when they aren't having to deal with new cases coming in and people at the counter. So we've got some freed up work time at the end of the day. So OCS has reported by having half a day every week where there are no court appearances, they can do other work as well. And the same with attorneys have told us that actually the closure at noon on Friday is not such a bad thing at all. It doesn't keep people in jail longer. They're on the same schedule because there are always judges available for emergency proceedings, bails, and that type of thing continues even though the general court doors are closed at noon on Friday.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow up, Representative Wilson.
So as I sit in court and I sat through a termination hearing not long. It took over about 6 months because every time they got started, they ran into somebody else having to be there. There was never enough time. Or even at a beginning one, the judge will look at their schedule and literally have to go 4 to 5 weeks out for anything to be scheduled. So it may not have anything to do with Friday afternoon, but it seems like there is some kind of issue where, you know, cases that might need to be seen sooner because the judge is so filled. So what would cause that? I mean, do we not have enough judges for the cases that we're having, or can we get any kind of numbers on, you know, criminal cases, how long, you know, 6 months out, 2 years? Same thing with some of the other civil cases to get a better idea of. But I just know when I sit in court, you know, the judges, they keep flipping because they're trying to find some open time. So there's got to be an issue going on. Maybe it has nothing to do with Friday. Maybe there's just more cases out there. But any information you could give would be helpful.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, you're right. Courts are very busy. And frequently, cases have to be scheduled out months in advance, sometimes weeks. And it depends on the type of case, too. Those cases tend to move faster than, say, general civil cases because there aren't statutory timelines. So every time the legislature or the federal government puts a timeline on a case type, all those that don't benefit from the timeline get moved further and further out.
Thank you.
Representative Thompson and Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doug, you know, your final bullet point on this page is expanded use of video conferencing. Are we still a little bit behind because of broadband not expanding enough? Would it save us a lot more money in travel and things if we had expanded broadband?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, we're pretty good on broadband now. Over the last, not the last few years, but prior to that, back when we still had money, the legislature gave us additional funds for broadband. And that helps enormously, and not only for the court, but like in Southeast Alaska, they use video conferencing for court hearings all the time. And throughout the rest of the state, they do as well, but particularly here in Southeast, which means that a judge can sit in Ketchikan and preside over a case in Juneau. And this, or the litigants can be somewhere, the Juneau judge can be in Juneau and the litigants could be in Ketchikan. But one of the biggest savings associated with video conferencing is for prisoner transport. Not very long ago, and you probably, this may be what you're thinking of, we used to, the Department of Public Safety would charter an aircraft and fly from Anvil Mountain Correctional Facility in Nome with a prisoner for a short hearing in Kotzebue. Well, that just seems crazy. And now there's a video link between Kotzebue Courthouse and Anvil Mountain, and that's because of the bandwidth. And this year, in fact, I'll probably get to this later. Maybe I'll forget, so I'll mention it now. We, in FY18, we're going to be saving just about $900,000 in bandwidth costs because we're moving to a different system. I don't understand all the details of it, but it's a system that we manage ourselves rather than pay GCI to manage, and that will save us another about $900,000 a year. Video conferencing is fabulous. It's also, we use it for sign language interpreters, spoken language interpreters, where you can contract with people outside the state and have those services provided at a fraction of the cost.
Representative Guttenberg, and then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to follow up before I ask my question on Representative Thompson's comments. I'm not sure it's the the bandwidth issue in a lot of communities is not the availability, it's the cost, mm-hmm. right? If you were conducting business out in Dillingham, it would absorb all, I mean, at a larger scale than you are, it would absorb all of your costs. Broadband out of Dillingham is prohibitively expensive for everybody, except the libraries who get 90% of it paid by federal subsidies. The Terra Southwest fiber optics, which was built with public money, the state doesn't get any benefit out of that except that it's there. The costs are exorbitant. But the libraries and health centers in rural Alaska have their own rates and their own funds in the FEC that are set aside. Is there anything that your judicial system has that the costs are subsidized or covered or giving you a priority of use? Because all the things you were talking about, prisoner transport, which isn't your budget, which is public safety budget, probation, all those things that can stay out there are come at, are dealing with somebody else's budget. But do you have, is there any FEC funds or programs set aside that directly affect the court system and its ability to function? Because we're unique in the country on this stuff. I mean, it's clear that nobody else has a prisoner transportation cost. I mean, there's the whole list of things. So is there anything in federal legislation or the FEC programs, Connect America and all those programs that benefit the courts directly?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, not that I'm aware of, but I will find out. And our chief financial officer, Rhonda McLeod, is listening, and I'm sure she's taking notes too to see if see what's available or what isn't available.
Okay.
Good. Thank you, Representative Ortiz.
Chairman, Doug, could you briefly explain your mini retirement incentive program and how much you think that saved the court system?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Ortiz, through the chair. This past summer, our administrative director came up with the idea of trying to offer, offering a retirement incentive program to some of our employees. She offered it to employees who had been with the court at least 10 years, who had been eligible to, and who had been eligible to retire for at least 3 years. The incentive to retire was 3 months severance pay. And I think there were 28 people eligible for this program, and I think we have now we've got 16 of those who went with that program, and that will save us over $600,000 next year. The position was either held vacant, if we could hold it vacant, or it was replaced with a part-time employee, if we could do that, or if we still needed that as a full-time position, it was replaced with a full-time employee, but at a much lower salary. So, a lot of these people were way out in the step areas, so we could replace them with, a step A or B, and save. That's where we saved a considerable amount of money. These are the types of programs we like, because not only does the employee think it's a very good deal, but it saves the court system a great deal of money. And it's been a very successful program. I know in the past sometimes the retirement incentive program doesn't work out quite as well as you hope. This one's been very successful so far.
Thank you.
Because three-quarters of our budget is personal services, that's where most of our savings have come from, and we've realized those savings by holding dozens and dozens of positions vacant, deleting lots and lots of positions, even the PCNs. Right, we've got the Friday afternoon closures, which result in a pay cut for our employees. That's where most of our savings have come from. But we've also, there are a million other things that we do that save money, small things, big things, all kinds of stuff that we do. The purchasing of a computers. There's fewer trainings for judges. Those come with a cost. You want to train, and you need to replace computers. But there are ways that we can, at least in the short term, reduce our budget. For FY18, we've got, $3.67 million. We're asking for additional reductions. That's kind of where they're all coming from. But going back to something I just mentioned, there are kind of two types of budget cuts. One type is just emergency, got to cut it because you just don't have any money, like replacement of computers or judicial training. But you don't want to always have that money gone. If the state some days returned to a state of plenty and we could have additional money, we would want to get more judicial training than we currently are doing, more clerical training than we're currently doing. We want to replace computers again on a regular cycle. But there are other types of savings that are forever, and those are the ones that we really try to find. And those, for example, when our e-filing comes online, which the first major phase will be in the next several months, we will need fewer staff. So a lot of those staffing positions that we are now holding vacant, we won't have to ever refill those. Those are long-term savings that make a lot of sense. The reduced cost in bandwidth, that's a savings that we hope to see going forward forever. There are programs like this. We now distribute a lot more of our materials through emails rather than through the mail. This saves us hundreds of thousands of dollars in printing costs, postage costs, paper costs. All of those kinds of things are savings that we will realize not only in the short term but in the long term as well. And when we can, those are the types of savings we like to find.
And before we go on, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Wolliver, you know, the recent decision and memorandum of understanding with the Anvik tribe about them taking over cases, having tribal courts, does this have the potential to save the state court system a lot of money in the future?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, probably not a lot of money, at least in the near future. There are a relatively small number of cases, but I know that it's the court has a lot for many years liked the idea of local communities being able to resolve some of those small issues that arise in the community. I know the governor's interested in that. We've just, in fact, entered into our first joint state court, tribal court, therapeutic court in Kenai with the Kenaitse tribe. And it's a voluntary program. It's not just for members of the tribe, but it's a therapeutic court program with both a tribal court judge and a state court judge sitting on the bench together. But it's a voluntary program, and they can participate or not, but it's one of those types of efforts that we're seeing and encouraging. This slide basically just shows where our money comes from. Again, you can see where it goes. Our funding allocations, again, almost all general fund. The various sections we have, appropriations we have for appellate courts, trial courts. These are the fees that we bring in each year, about $7 million in those from those various categories. We've got a designation there for constitutional requirement versus statutory requirement. Not sure exactly how you break those out, but that's how they're broken out. You'd also ask for Alaskan served. This one we have to wrestle with a little bit. In what way do we serve people? Well, we serve people in a whole bunch of different ways. And so we decided to put out some of these numbers for you to take a look at. 120,000 cases. Well, that's not 120,000 people. Half of those, you know, all the criminal cases, one half of that is the government. Some civil cases have lots of people involved in that. We've got 7,000 people through our Family Law Self-Help Center. But a couple of areas I did want to touch on a little bit, and those are the number of people who access the court system for case files, or, you know, searching for cases, and people who access the court for forms and booklets. So as you know, everybody uses CourtView. Everybody looks up CourtView for a whole host of reasons. Well, those people in the past either didn't look up anything or they came to court to find those files. Well, this is a huge savings for convenience for citizens to look up records, and it's a savings for the court because we don't have long lines of people asking for quick case files. And maybe even more important are the thousands of online forms that we now have. Last year, about 30,000 people viewed our landlord-tenant booklet. About 25,000 people viewed our booklet on small claims cases. That's 50,000 people that looked at court forms. That's 50,000 court booklets we didn't print. I mean, our printing costs have gone down dramatically. I mean, not just in the last couple of years, but over the years. We add more and more and more things online for people to access. This is a great savings for individual citizens. They don't have to come to court to get a booklet or a form. And it means people aren't coming to the court counter to get them, and we don't have to print them. There are a lot of things like that. And then one other thing that's, I think, particularly interesting on there is 19,000 people with online payments. Most of those are traffic tickets. But again, that's 19,000 people that didn't come into court with a check in their hand to give to a clerk that had to be processed, and 19,000 people. So it saves the court time and effort, and it saves the person time and effort. They just take care of it online. So in terms of Alaskan Serves, that's one way to look at it. Yes.
So thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you have 595 therapeutic court participants. Mm-hmm. How many actually graduated?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can get you that number for FY16, the total number of graduates.
And a follow-up?
A follow-up, Representative Wilson.
Because first of all, that comes out about $8,000 per person. That's why I want to know how many actually graduated. Mm-hmm. But as far as court fees, when was the last time court fees were adjusted?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, last year. We raised it had prior to that it had been about a dozen years since we had raised court filing fees, and we raised them, I think it was early FY16.
So. Thank you.
And you also asked effectiveness ratings. Again, we thought, well, how do we measure that? So here are a couple of stabs at it. One is our case clearance rates. Every year, so many cases come into the court. We need, on average, to send out and resolve the same number of cases. They aren't all the same cases. Cases can be filed in November, resolved to, you know, a year later. But overall, we have a 100% case clearance rate. That means over the years, as many cases are resolved as come into the court. So we're not, you know, going further and further and further behind. But another issue I'd like to talk about in terms of effectiveness, one thing up there are alternative dispute resolution. We've got a program there that is incredibly effective. It is the called the Early Resolution Project. It's a mediated settlement for family law cases, which would be divorces and child custody cases. We've done this for about 6.5 years or so. Throughout that time, we've had about 1,400 cases, so I was told today, a little over 3,000 people. Rather than going through this regular route of scheduling a court hearing and having a variety of court hearings spread out over months to get your divorce case resolved, participants in these programs, there's one day scheduled. They come in, volunteer attorneys from the local bar association meet with the couple. They mediate their dispute, their divorce or their child custody. They meet a judge. The judge issues approves the settlement, and they walk out the door that afternoon with their case completely over. 80% of the people who come into this program settle, and almost all of them within one day. Now, if you compare that to your normal, when you think about a divorce case, this saves time for the court because we don't have these hearings to schedule, but it saves an enormous amount of time for the litigants. It saves a lot of them a lot of money, and it saves an awful lot of people a lot of frustration as well. It's an incredibly effective program. We're really proud of it, and it's run by our Family Law Self-Help Center. So that's what I have, but I'd be happy to answer or try to answer any questions, and if there are some particularly difficult ones, I've got Rhonda on the line.
Thank you, and I think Representative Guttenberg, did you have a question?
I'll pass. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. It looks like we're going to get to adjourn a minute and a half early. So
that's part of our efficiency at the court system.
There we are. And remember that the further details will be sought out from all members of the House in the finance subcommittees, which are meeting there, and you can follow those online on AKA Leg TV. And we will look forward to our next meeting. And I don't think I have the script to tell me. Oh, yes, I do. So next meeting will be Tuesday at 1:30, and we will have department overviews from Health and Social Services, Department of Natural Resources, and a presentation on tourism funding model. The tourism marketing funding. So we'll be adjourned at our minute and a half's gone, so it's 3:30.